Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you. Good to see you too.
Good to see you.
Everybody be seated. Find a place. Good to see you. You doing, Bob?
Good to see everybody here.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Main Street Universe. Aristotle once wrote, "It is a mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it." Plutarch said, "What we change inwardly will change our outer reality." Pythagoras spoke of transmigration. Whether it was the great classical thinkers or the alchemists, scientists later on, such as Cornelius Agrippa or Nicolas Flamel, magics, metaphysics, used to be considered a very serious aspect of scientific study. Magic was not something separate from science or scientific study and was put to the scientific method. The great doctors of old were often wizards or witches, incorporating plant, herbal studies, as well as working with metals and elemental reactions. Tonight, we will interview a modern real-life wizard. We are very grateful to welcome to our show Mr. Oberon Zell Ravenheart. Join us in our circle tonight on Main Street Universe. Reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. And I don't know about you, but I can imagine a lot. I'd like to start off with some brief station announcements and then get to our guest this evening, who I see in the queue. Monday nights, 8 p.m., We have Walking on the Sidewalk, A Horizon Oracle's Journey with your host, Mr. Kevin Baird. Kevin Baird is a creator and artist. He created the On the Horizon Oracle deck. That's 8 p.m. Monday evenings. Tuesdays coming up, starting next Tuesday, we will have Mary Phelan. Mary, she'll be coming on at 10:30, and she is the hostess of a television show known as Telepathic
TV. Yes.
And Janice here knows Mary, and hello, Janice.
Very well.
How are you?
Hi, everybody.
And Wednesdays, of course, you're listening to Main Street
Universe,
the show that started it all, the flagship show. 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and then on Friday evenings, we have Jessie Ann Nichols-George with her show Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. Jessie is the author of two books, Activating Compassion and Activating Compassion, the Workbook, the Companion Workbook. She has a lot of great guests and a lot of interesting things and great advice, so check her out at midnight for our highest rated show, Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. And on Sundays, our other new host, Mr. Darren Boucaire, who is a reader at Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo in New Orleans, the magical city.
Magical city.
Which I got some souvenirs from. My brother and his wife visited there recently.
Wonderful city.
So Darren had the privilege this week of being on the Ellen DeGeneres show. It was a funny promo she was doing where she had a Super Bowl contest. So it was in New Orleans. And our team won, by the way, the Baltimore Ravens.
Yes. Ravens took it to the mat.
Janice and I are both from Baltimore, formerly at some point in our lives. And part of the package for this contest was you go to the Super Bowl, you get a ticket. It was on the Ellen show, and you get a New Orleans, you know, magical city. You get a free reading, and Darren was the one chosen for the reading, so he was on as a featured guest to do some readings for the women on the show. So
very cool.
Darren's got a lot of interesting things. He's a great reader and was one of my early tarot teachers. So this evening we have a guest, someone who has been in the pagan community for a pretty good while, and I'm going to go ahead, instead of me talking about him, I'm going to go ahead and bring him on.
Yes.
And ask him some questions.
Yes.
And get this ball rolling.
Let's get the ball rolling.
Let me go ahead and get this microphone on. I see him there. Hold for the count of three. One, two, three. Here's your symbol. Are you there, Oberon Zell Ravenheart?
Indeed I am. I'm delighted to be here.
All right.
Very nice to talk to you this evening, sir.
Thank you. So, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I just figured that since about the 1960s, you had done a couple of things, and maybe we would talk about some of that.
Yeah, it occurs to me that I've probably been doing this longer than just about anybody alive. There's only a couple of people I know who've been at it longer than I have. It's been, this will be 51 years this year. So
a long time. Congratulations.
Mm. Thank you.
Jeff, you will. Bring me to my first question. And that will be very simple, maybe, and remember back those 51 years. When did you first realize, or think you realized, that you wanted to learn to become a wizard or get involved in magic and metaphysics?
Oh, my goodness. I think that goes all the way back to when I was a kid and I first started reading stories of magic and wonder. My very first, earliest reading as a child, and I was a very precocious reader, was children's version of the Greek myths. And that led into mythology and fantasy and science fiction and just all of that stuff. And, you know, many of these stories, most of them had magical characters in them, wizards very commonly. And I realized that most people were intended to identify with the young heroes in the stories, but I always identified with the wizards. I was much more attracted by Merlin than I was by, say, Arthur, you know, in the Sword and the Stone. And so it went all the way through in all these stories, and I love them. Each new iteration that comes out I find just fascinating, you know, whether it's Lord of the Rings or Star Wars or Harry Potter or whatever, because what I find fascinating is that the wizards in all of these stories are very coherent and very authentic. You know, lots of things may vary a lot, but the archetype of the wizard is a very fundamental and basic and universal archetype. And it's a good one. It's one I really like. He appears as the mentor and of the young hero and the teacher, the guide, the one who knows stuff that nobody else knows and therefore can do stuff that nobody else can do because, you know, he has secrets and secret knowledge and lore and all of that. I found very appealing, all of that, and I still do. And so my searches through my life and my quests and my studies have always been into the unexplored territories, those areas off the map where there may be dragons or other interesting things. And I've had a wonderful adventures in those realms.
All right. And I wanted to comment on one thing you said, is I agree, and Janice put a big thumbs up at that point, too, of when you mentioned when you'd read these stories, here's the person that they were proposing to be the hero or the antagonist or protagonist, I'm sorry. And this wizard would help them in some of these stories. And I always remember thinking the same thing. I'm like, first of all, I think, okay, here's this wizard character. Couldn't this guy kind of be in the hero's position? Couldn't he be taking care of this? So I would often be attracted to the wizard character as well.
Well, I think one of the neatest stories along those lines was one that David Carradine did called, originally it was titled The Silent Flute, which is the perfect title, but it was re-released in America as The Circle of Iron, which was, they tried to make it a martial arts movie because it was had David Carradine, but it wasn't really. It was a story of the hero's journey, but the interesting thing in the story is that the wizard mentor in the story is always doing these things that seem incomprehensible, and he always knows what's going on. And as the story completes itself all around and makes a complete cycle, you know, you come to an understanding that he has himself taken this exact same route and path, and that is what gives him the insights and the wisdom to help the next ones along. And I find that very, very significant in my understanding of the cycles of the world. One of the most interesting cycles I've discovered that nobody else seems to have remarked upon, I can't believe I'm the only one really, but I haven't seen any notice of this really, is the 60-year cycle of renaissances that has occurred pretty solidly, consistently for at least the last 600 years or so. I haven't really traced it back much further than the 1400s, but it goes back at least to the Italian Renaissance. And 60 years later, it was the English Renaissance, and it goes right on, you know, through Renaissance after Renaissance. The 1840s was the Transcendental Renaissance period, and of course, the turn of the century, the fin de siècle, and the 1960s. And now we're coming up, the next one will be coming up in the 2020s. And each of these has had certain common themes in emergences magic and goddess worship and rediscovery of paganism and arts and beauty and music and everything. It's been these wonderful little periods of this, some of them bigger than others. If they coincide with larger cycles, like 500-year cycles, then there's really big ones. And if there's ones that coincide with millennial cycles, then they get really big and so on. But the interesting thing about that is that 60 years is just the right amount of time for those who were coming of age in one cycle and being therefore the young heroes, say in their teens and 20s, to then become the wise old wizards in the next cycle 60 years later to be there to guide and mentor the next generation. And I think that is really interesting, and I'm very much, having been in that position in the 60s, I look very much forward to taking my role in the 20s to come.
And that's a great point. I'm glad you mentioned the cycles and what becomes respected. And I view the 60s as far as that most recent example, I view it as there was pressure going on, way too much conformist pressure. And as you said, sometimes the releasing of that pressure comes with, like, something has to give, and it comes with a recognition of the power or the wisdom, the intuitive wisdom of divine feminine and of feminine wisdom. So that'll take me naturally to my next question and to that time period, which would be, what was it like during those days as far as outreach when you were sort of trying to spread this during the 60s and such? Did you find difficulties meeting other pagans and outreaching? Or just maybe some commentary on those days, because a lot of these younger pagans don't know the story of the early neo-pagan times, such as the 60s and 70s, one could say.
Oh, I know. Well, these times have been chronicled very beautifully in a number of books. The most recommended, of course, would be Margot Adler's Drawing Down the Moon, which really tells about that. But the thing is that back in the in those days, there wasn't a movement or a community as such. We had to create it out of whole cloth. Those that had come before had been pretty much obliterated from memory and awareness. I mean, they could be, and were eventually rediscovered and re-excavated as the new generations tried to dig deeper and find out where we came from. But in those days, we had no idea of our forebears, of the Golden Dawn era and all, and the ones that went before us. So we were just thought we were completely out there on our own. But the interesting thing about that, and being young, I think, in such a time, is the idea of infinite possibilities. You know, there is nothing that you can think you can't do. You know, you're immortal and invincible, and all the possibilities lie before you. And coming into the world with that attitude and being suffused with myths and stories as we were, the most important thing really about all this stuff, about wizardry and magic and lore and all of it, is stories. We are beings of story. We live in story. We create story. We inhabit story. The story is everything. It's who and what we are. We don't exist apart from story. And this is a profound thing, because if we look around us, the world that we consider the world of our reality is stories. It's all stories. And people fight wars over stories, and they build nations around stories and have religions around stories. And they love and they hate based on stories. And these stories, these are very malleable. You know, I mean, any storyteller can come in and introduce new stories or reshape the stories. And look at the power in our just recent times of some of the modern storytellers that we see, people like J.R.R. Tolkien or J.K. Rowling's or James Cameron with Avatar, these kind of things. And these are just stories, right, which is things that are not taken seriously by the powers that rule the world, but they are ultimately the power, ultimately. And the thing about storytelling is anybody can play. You don't have to be rich or powerful. You don't have to come from aristocracy or from, you know, families. You don't even require great education. I mean, you know, J.K. Rowling was just a welfare mother sitting down in a little cafe to take the story out of her head and put it onto paper. So, and yet, this is where the greatest power lies, and it shapes the future in the world, because we draw for our inspiration upon the stories of the past. So those of us who come into these times, these periods, these are always periods in which things seem the darkest, and it's doom and gloom. The 60s was a time when we can think of all the really exciting, fun stuff going on, but it was also the time of the nuclear doom, of the sword of Damocles, of the mushroom cloud that hung over our heads. You know, one of the stories I like to tell about that time was that in 1960, right at the beginning of it, George Pell made a movie based on H.G. Wells' story, The Time Machine. And in that movie, the time traveler stops his time machine, and right at the time that there is a global nuclear holocaust occurs, right? And the date on the chronometer is August something of 1966. And in 1960, 6 years down the line, did not seem an unlikely date at all for a global nuclear holocaust. Seemed perfectly reasonable. And so that was the vision that was in that story that was commonly accepted by everybody. The stories in that time of the future didn't go beyond there. There was going to be the inevitability of a global nuclear holocaust, and we were all going to die, or we'd be slugging it out with the mutants and the radioactive ruins, you know, and that would be it. But what happened was just 2 months after that date, in October of that year, and I could pull out the exact dates, but it's not relevant, a totally new story was introduced that changed everything. And that story was Star Trek, which premiered on television at that time and introduced a totally different future, which did not exist before that time. You know, there was no vision of the future. And so into that blank space, into that untold blank page of the stories of the future, Gene Roddenberry inserted one, you know, that became so compelling that our modern world today has been enormously shaped by that vision. I mean, especially our technology. I mean, just, you know, reach into your pocket and take a look at what you have and go, oh, you know.
So I would like to comment on that. I think that both Star Trek, especially I thought later on The Next Generation, was literally one of the best written shows ever on television with its inspiration.
I totally agree. In fact, as I'm talking to you right now, I'm sitting here wearing a shirt that is that it looks exactly like a Star Trek Next Generation shirt in the colors and stuff, and so I've pinned a little communicator thing to it just to wear around, and people just love it. I get just the happiest looks from people as I go around with it, you know.
And Denise?
I love Star Trek. I keep looking at old episodes all the time. I'm Denise, and I noticed that you're one of my friends, so welcome. But I wanted to talk about the 60s, because it was also a time where you had Sybil Leake and Dionne Fortune and Doreen Valiente, and really towards the ending of Gerald Gardner, which is a lot of people that helped mold and shape some of the parts of modern-day Wicca. And you had said that you had started about 51 years ago. So you started way before I was born. Well, maybe not that way before I was born, but...
Well, I marked my official entry in 1962, but that's another story. Please continue.
Oh, okay. Okay. So I was wondering how much contact did you have with these ladies and gentlemen back in the 60s when you were all creating Wicca, or what would be modern-day Wicca?
Or
well, neo-paganism.
Right. Well, and that's a very important distinction. I had no involvement whatsoever in the creation of the modern-day Wicca thing during that period, because it wasn't presented that way. You see, that was what was very interesting. The bit of witchcraft that leaked across came through from a few authors like Sybil Leake, and Louise Huebner and a few others, and they all conveyed a certain mythos about witchcraft, and that was that witches were sort of like a subspecies. They weren't exactly the same as normal mortal people. In fact, they used the term mortals to refer to people who were not witches. And a good example of that is the story Bell Book and Candle, the movie. But the same thing for the TV series Bewitched. And many other treatments, almost all of them, conveyed this idea that witches were not the same as ordinary people. So ordinary people could not become witches. You couldn't do this. You had to be born into the lineage. And that's what these people all said. That's what Sybil Leake said and Louise Huebner said and Justine Glass and all these people who were writing books about being witches. So those of us who did not share that particular heritage didn't even give it another thought. We thought, well, that was interesting, but it never occurred to us that we might become that. And that's not what they were saying. That wasn't what they were telling us at all. Now, Gardner did talk about that one could do this. He talked about the witchcraft as the old religion. But that was obviously silly because, you know, anybody who had studied the old ways and old cultures and stuff knew perfectly well that, you know, everybody in the village was not witches. It wasn't their religion of the people. The witch was someone who lived at the edge of the village and was a shamaness, basically, or, you know, she did herbalism and healing and stuff like that. But it was a role. It was a craft, like being the village blacksmith or the village weaver. You know, there would be the village witch. And so the idea of this as a religion just didn't make any sense at all. So it was kind of weird. What we were doing in America is we were reviving paganism as the old religion. And we consider witches to have a role in that, the same way that there is always a shaman in the village, in any pagan village anywhere. And that's how we thought of it. But I seem to have been the first person to have actually claimed the word pagan as a self-identification in 1967. And prior to that time, there were people trying to recreate Greek tradition or Egyptian, and almost all of these druids were college students. I was a college student at the time in 1962, and that was kind of how they all started. All these different groups started as college students who were exploring mythology and comparative religion and anthropology and all that stuff, and got really intrigued by the ancient ways and traditions of different cultures. And said, well, let's try to recreate some of this. And started holding rites and rituals and recreating things, and before long it got serious. And but nobody was talking to each other. None of these folks were talking to each other. That was my role. That's kind of what I did. Is that I claimed a term that could include everybody, and then I started promoting it to everybody, saying, "Hey guys, here's something that we all are. We're all pagans." And more people said, "Yeah, that's what we are. We're all pagans." And that took off until before long we had a pagan movement. And I like to compare this with what Benjamin Franklin did. He was asked one time what was his greatest invention, and he said Americans, because he was the one who coined the term American as a self-identification for all these people. And before that, people thought of themselves as, oh, Virginians or New Yorkers or Baptists or Puritans or Quakers or whatever they were. But they didn't have anything that united them as in a single thing. When he promoted the term Americans, this made possible eventually an American Revolution. Because again, it's stories. We live by the stories. And having names that we can identify with and terms gives us an ability to talk about things and to tell stories about them. So that was kind of what happened there. I did meet Sybil Leek one time. She came to the United States on a tour in, oh, let's see, 66 or 7, something like that. I was in graduate school at the time. And I went to hear her lecture, and I sat in the front row and said, okay, here's this witch. I'd read her book, and I was really excited. I was, oh, boy, I'm going to this witch. So I started telepathically trying to beam to her to connect with her, figuring, okay, she's a witch. And I'd been doing telepathy experiments with my friends for years. Seriously. I mean, that was, you know, a thing we were into, hypnosis and telepathy experiments and all that stuff. And I'd gotten pretty good at it, you know. So I'm sitting there beaming this stuff at her, figuring that she'll connect with me. And nothing happened at all. There was no connection at all. I went up and, you know, had her sign my book and stuff. But I was somewhat disappointed. She didn't really impress me as I had hoped that she might. But a few years later, in 1970, I met a local witch, young witch, named Debbie Letter, who had opened an occult shop, the first occult shop in St. Louis, and it was called The Cauldron. And I was in St. Louis at that time, and I'd gone there for graduate school and ended up staying for quite a while. And so I went in and checked it out, and got to talk with her, and I thought it was all really neat stuff, and I was just fascinated, and she and I really hit it off. And she was starting to teach classes, so I signed up for her classes and was in the very first of them. And if you look on her website today, all these many, many years later, she's now Deborah Bourbon, and her store is now called Pathways, but she still has a store in St. Louis, and she lists me on her website as being one of her first students, and I think that that's very cool that my old teacher still thinks so well of me. And I've been back there since in recent years, and it's really neat. So that was a big move forward for me to actually get serious training in the craft, and I did, and I got initiated and all that stuff. But I've never really thought of myself as a Wiccan or a witch primarily. My identity was much more towards the wizard archetype and pagan archetype and all of that, you know. So, witchcraft is definitely something that it's a part of me, but it's not the primary identity that I have.
Okay, and I myself am drawn to the terms pagan or occultist, is sort of how I'm drawn to. Now, Janice is also, because she's of an age close to mine, which I won't reveal, because I won't reveal a lady's age.
No, better not.
But she's a few more years wiser than me, but at that time where people were using the word Wiccan, which very interchangeably, and even with pagan, sometimes very interchangeably around the 70s and such. But onward from that, and still, well, I do want to clarify over, I'm just get to modern stuff and your modern projects. I definitely wanted to start with some history, because especially because we get a lot more listens in the archives as well as live and on ways you can't see live.
Mm.
I know you understand how this medium works.
Yes.
Some of the younger people don't know some of the history, and some of them are actually quite disrespectful to their elders who brought this whole thing about. But I won't get into that conversation right now yet. If we want to rant a little bit, we'll give you the chance. But I want to start right off now, similar time frame, and then again, I will give you plenty of time to plug your modern things. We'll stay into the past for a little bit. And tell us about the Church of All Worlds and what inspired it.
Oh, right. Well, that's a great story, and that's really where my serious entry into the pagan movement itself began, and that was that I had grown up in the 50s going to high school. If you've seen the movie Pleasantville, that was the world I grew up in. It was just like that. Lived in a suburbia that was all, everything was in black and white, you know, and it was just like that. And but during that entire period, during the 50s, every year for 12 years, Robert Heinlein wrote a new juvenile science fiction book in which his characters advanced each year. It would be a year older, sort of like J.K. Rowling's doing her Harry Potter stories, 1 year advancement. And for all those years, that was my mentor and guide, and I happened to be the same age as the heroes in the stories as the stories progressed. And finally, in 1960, I had finished college. I finished high school and started college in 1961, right at the beginning of the 60s, you know, when everything turned into color. And the book that came out that year was Strange in a Strange Land. And it took the story to the next level in pretty much the same way that my life and the lives of all those of my contemporaries had moved to the next level. We were suddenly no longer living at home. We were now out into the world. And the story that he created for us at that point was appropriate to that era. It introduced issues of sex and drugs and rock and roll and religion and all kinds of stuff that had never really been treated in science fiction before. And this was profound and revelatory, and I'm not going to try to encapsulate the plot here, but I highly recommend it. It's quite an amazing book. Even today, it's still remarkable, although you do have to realize that it was written over 50 years ago, you know. But it was very, very significant. In the story, Well, I have to say this much about it, I guess. The story involves a child who was born on the planet Mars, but he was raised by Martians because he was the only survivor of the first expedition from Earth to Mars that crashed, and everybody died, but one of the women was pregnant, and the ancient Martians were able to save the unborn child and raise him up. And then 20 years later, an expedition from Earth, another expedition goes there and discovers him there and brings him back to Earth. And that's kind of the setting. And so from that perspective of having been raised in a vastly superior but alien culture, this child of Earth sees everything that we take for granted in a completely different way. I often think of it like we take a baby chimpanzee from the jungle and we raise him up in civilization and we teach him to wear clothes and to speak with hand language and do all kinds of things. And imagine then if we just send him back to the jungle, you know. How would it be? And how would the others relate to him? Well, that's kind of what happens here. And in the process, he ends up creating this church called the Church of All Worlds. And it introduces a lot of really significant religious themes, including immanent divinity, the idea that divinity is not something outside there somewhere, but within all of us, expressed in the phrase, thou art goddess, thou art God. It has the idea of priestesses, which was totally unique. The priestesses only exist in pagan religions. No non-pagan religions have priestesses, so that was pretty amazing. It deals with things like sex and ritual nudity and all kinds of things that were being eventually came into the mainstream viewpoint from aspects of witchcraft and occultism and such, but were certainly unheard of in mainstream religious thinking at that time, and all kinds of stuff. And one of these was the sacrament of water, the water being the universal medium of all life everywhere in the universe that we all share. And therefore, the idea is that water shared is life shared. And the fundamental ceremony is simply the sharing of water. And on April 7th of 1962, my first and oldest friend, Lance Christie, and I, who had met the very first weekend in college that year, we sat down together, having both read the book and talked about it at great length, and we shared a glass of water, and we pledged ourselves to living our lives according to certain precepts and principles, and we began what we've came to consider the ultimate conspiracy for all the years since then, and we've never veered from it in all of that time. And sadly, Lance just died a couple of years ago, and it was a huge blow to me. He and I were like Kirk and Spock to each other. When Star Trek premiered, we really identify with those archetypes. He was the Spock character, I should be clear about. He was brilliant and wise and all kinds of good stuff. But I was the adventurous, crazy guy who went out and got laid and stuff. You know? And we were a great team. And the work that we did together was amazing. And so at some point, by the time we completed college, we had created a water brotherhood of about 100 people that were based on these principles, and it was very much of a kind of a secret underground fraternity, the Church of All Worlds-y thing. And when we got out of college, we spread out around the country, and we started corresponding and communicating on what to do about all this. Should we keep this something secret just among us, or should we take it public? Because there's probably other people like us out there, too, who would like to know that they're not alone. Because really, that was it. Lance and I had been changelings, like so many pagans, many people who come into it, are people who felt that they were looking for something else, that they belonged somewhere else, that they were, you know, that were not a part of the families or communities they grew up in. And when they find each other, when we find each other, really, the first thing that always comes to us is you say, I feel like I finally come home. I feel like I finally found my people. And that's a profound thing. Paganism is called the religion without converts, because we don't go around converting anybody or proselytizing. We just find our way home. So that was the discussion that we had at great length. And there was quite a lot to it at that time, because the idea of starting a religion had its concerns as well. I mean, Jesus started a religion that seemed pretty nice for quite a while. But 1,000 years later, they were like waging holy wars and burning people at the stake for heresy. And we said, wow, you know, we don't want to start a religion and then have 1,000 years later people are waging holy wars and burning people at the stake in our name, you know. That
yes.
would be terrible.
We're arguing in forums on the internet.
yeah. Well, that's a little safer, but, you know. So we,
but
we,
I did want to comment on that, because a lot of pagans and a lot of people that feel called to the pagan past somehow, by their independent nature in general, which is one of the reasons I think why Stranger in a Strange Land, just the title of the book is appealing to people that might be.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is the idea that they don't like the R word. They don't like the word religion. And keep in mind, I have a very sort of non-heavy attachment to the word religion. I just view it etymologically. It comes down to meaning the things that we do together. There's other ways to break it etymologically. So it's not a bad thing. Like, I'm not uncomfortable in a church. I don't have anything against Christians. I'm not one of those pagans that's anti-Christian or any of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Many pagans are into Christian symbolism, in fact, like you know, conjuration and all of these other things, and still like to keep there. The cross is, after all, the four elements. And that'll bring me loosely, as I drifted, to my next question, though, but it is tied into what we were discussing. But I did want to discuss that, because the idea of religion, does that word scares a lot of pagans or people that are interested in the past.
It does. It's been a real issue. In fact, many people would say, why do you call yourself a church, you know, because church of all worlds, you know, and why do you call yourself a religion, because they really, and the thing is that, that certain religions that I, well, certain groups or people or whatever, have given a bad name to the whole idea by this churchianity thing, and I wish we could just refer to churchianity and make that distinct from religion. Because I'm not at all comfortable with people rejecting the term religion and just using the word spirituality. I don't think of what I do as spirituality. I think of spirituality as the stuff that is, well, it's personal, for one thing. It's not what you do with other people. It's your own personal spirituality. But it also has to do with just matters of the spirit, whereas paganism and religion, to me, concerns everything. It concerns the material world as well as the spiritual realms and such. And I'm not one of these anti-materialist, airy-fairy spiritual kind of guys, you know. I'm not comfortable with that, you know. So it's an issue, and it always has been, really.
And I understand completely. Because without... Now, I understand that you wanted to guard against, say, if you're trying to start, in this case, a pagan tradition. And I've been a part of a few different pagan traditions and have been eclectic as well. I would like to make the point that it's necessary for progression as long as you guard against the corruptions, you know, that can happen in the ones that you left in the first place. And that's where it can become a fine line, because they start to grow, but then sometimes in their growth, they start to do the same corruptions that they've seen in the traditions that they left, whether it was Catholicism or whatever form of Christianity it was. So on to that will be my next question, is what do you consider to be the mission statement of the Church of All Worlds?
Well, actually, we have articulated that very well, and I'll just quote it to you. Hang on a second here. Because that is actually a very good question. The thing is, we realized pretty early on that we had to do more than just come up with our own thing that we wanted to do. I mean, that was pretty straightforward and simple. We could easily do that. But we needed to make it a little bigger than that, you know. So, you know, we formed this Water Brotherhood thing, you know, with other people that shared the stuff in common. And that was very cool, but it wasn't quite enough. So we decided that, well, we would have to go out, and eventually we concluded that we would have to take a public side as well. And so we retained the kind of a, you know, secret society thing, and also created a public facet that I was assigned for. I mean, it was Lance and I were basically chosen to take up these two different positions. Lance to head up the Atlan Foundation, which eventually became the Association for the Tree of Life, and I recommend you Google it if you want to see what his side did. And I was assigned to take the Church of All Worlds into a public venue. And that's when I first came out and started doing public things and started using the term pagan. And but our idea then was that, with it, like I said, this is the ultimate conspiracy. We realized that we needed to do more than just start our own church. We also needed to create a larger movement of which our church would only be one among many. So it wasn't, it was much, much bigger than that idea, and very, very insidious. And so here is the mission of the Church of All Worlds, is to evolve a network of information, mythology, and experience to awaken the divine within and to provide a context and stimulus for reawakening Gaia and reuniting her children through tribal community dedicated to responsible stewardship and the evolution of consciousness.
Okay. And that sounds very clear.
Mm.
And
yeah, that's
good, though. I like
statement.
That you have a focus and that you have a statement. And I also noticed that in the Church of All Worlds that you're involved in a number of projects. And one of them I saw while glazing over. I won't ask you to go too much about each individual project. But one I thought was kind of interesting was called the Forever Forest that you said was started by, in part by Gideon Penderwin, who I actually really like his song We Won't Wait Any Longer and actually play it in one of my sets.
Oh, yeah. It's classic. Gideon was amazing. He was our first great bard of our modern time, you know. But yeah, Forever Forest is a tree planting and land restoration project. And every year, since the late 70s, since we started it, we've held New Year's tree plantings. Some of them have been huge, with hundreds of people gathered over New Year's weekend to plant thousands of trees in various areas. We've made arrangements for people who've done land restoration projects and stuff, and some of them have just been in private places. And I've gone back in more recent years to some of these places that we had come into that were just devastation, that had been totally logged over and blasted, and come back 30 years later to them being beautiful, lush forests. It's quite a wonderful thing. And that's a good example of what we do, because to a great extent I felt that our work is all about planting seeds, planting seedlings that eventually grow up into be forests, and eventually the forests reseed themselves and spread. And I think that my work in the movement, in the community, has always been sort of the Johnny Appleseed thing.
I would as well like to ask about one, and right before I get to it, there will be another one of these projects, is I'd like to thank everyone in the chat room for showing up. We have my old co-host, Kevin Baird. We have Magical Hummingbird, Marcy Summers, Reverend Michael Frazier, Veronica, Jesse, and Nicholas George. We got a couple of our hosts from our network.
A couple of the hosts,
right.
Yes.
Well, hi, Kevin. Well, hi, guys.
Thank you, everybody, and some of these people helped promote this episode. So
wonderful.
Great to see everyone. And I'd like to go on to my next aspect of that same question, which was the ERA, which is the Ecosophical Research Association. If maybe you could go into a little bit of what they have done or what they were about as part of Church of All Worlds.
Sure. Well, the ERA's whole project has been to explore certain of the mythic, legendary things that have come down to us, and seek to study and to manifest things that were once considered to be purely mythical and legendary. Of course, all aspects of magic fall into that category. But the most famous project that we, the ERA, took on, of course, as I'm sure you would be ready to go into, is the recreation of the living unicorns, where we discovered the secret of the ancient unicorns and brought them back to the world for a while, which was a pretty amazing adventure, actually, a huge, huge story in itself.
Could you go a little bit into, because there's other questions we want to ask, and of course I know some people, including my nieces, if they happen to listen to this, are going to want to know how you maybe came about the unicorn secret.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was all part of what we started off. Morning Glory and I always had a fascination with you know, mythic beasties and critters and stuff. I mean, who doesn't love things like dragons and unicorns and mermaids and all that stuff? And we had this independent background in this stuff and fascination for it long before we'd met each other. And when we got together, we discovered that we knew a lot of nifty stuff that other people didn't seem to know about, and were, and we thought it'd be fun to write a book on the subject of the truth behind the myths. And so we embarked upon a research project just about the time that we ended up leaving St. Louis in a refurbished school bus that we spent about a year fixing up and building and traveling around the country and teaching at various places in universities and continuing our research. And during the process of that, I was the one who, I guess, initially made the discovery. We found some obscure reports and information on experiments that had been done with horn development in the 1930s and some references and materials and tribal stuff and all. And it was all around the idea that the unicorns, in fact, had actually existed and were created by a process that had been closely guarded secret, known only to, you know, the tribal shamans somewhere. So it was another one of these magical secret things, you know. It was, wow, that's really pretty cool. And we found out enough information that we felt we were able to reconstruct exactly how it had been done. And at that point, we said, wow, you know, this would be really a fascinating thing for their book, but on the other hand, maybe we could do it. You know, and we started talking it up with a few friends of ours at the time because we were pretty excited. And one of them had some land that she had just bought, a couple of hundred acres, 220 acres, and on a big, huge 5,600-acre hippie homesteading community ranch that was being created. And she said, well, I could use some caretakers on my land because I'm not planning on living there, but I want to be able to, you know, go up there. So if you guys want to do that, and go there and you can raise unicorns and be my caretakers. And so we said, sure, and that's what we did for the next 8 years. It's pretty much all we did was we homesteaded on the land and we raised unicorns. But it was successful. Our the research that we did and the skills and knowledge that we had. I mean, I'd been a med student, among other things, and an anatomist and animal husbandry guy. I've got a lot of those kind of skills. When we were able to create a generation of the most remarkable animals that I've ever had the experience of working with. And eventually we were able to arrange, well, it progressed. I mean, first we went out to Renaissance fairs because where else are you going to go with the unicorn, right? And going out to the Renaissance fairs with the unicorn, we had to create appropriate personas, and the only appropriate persona it seemed to be to going out there would be the wizard and the enchantress. So that was the first time that I became known as a wizard, started being identified that way, which eventually is something that became more and more my total identity. And eventually the Renaissance Fair circuit got bigger and bigger until we did every single Renaissance Fair in the United States and Canada. And for a period of time there, we were traveling around the country with four separate animals, with me doing one tour, Morning Glory doing another, and her daughter doing another one, and my son doing another one. All four of us, the whole family, was traveling around the country. And this eventually brought us to the attention of the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus. And we ended up with a contract with them for a 4-year exclusive exhibition lease, which became huge and worldwide. And the things just got just truly amazing. And all kinds of exciting adventures and stuff came out of that, including some bizarre controversy, which we could have easily resolved, but people didn't really want to talk to us about it. You know, it was very funny. We tried to get, scientists to come and talk to us about this stuff because we thought we had something really cool here. But all that they would say was, that can't be a real unicorn because real unicorns don't exist. And we'd always say, we got one of those too over here, this Harvey. He doesn't exist at all. But Lancelot here, now he's a real unicorn that does exist. So, but they kind of defined unicorns as something that doesn't exist. That didn't leave much room for us, you know.
Right, right.
That was quite a story in itself. That was a huge, huge thing. And it's pretty much all we did through the 80s. Our first unicorns were born in 1980 in the spring. And it's a big story. You can read all about it in my book, The Wizard's Bestiary. It's got a whole chapter on the unicorn story. And that was followed up with the Great Mermaid Adventure, where we traveled, did a diving expedition to the Coral Sea in New Guinea in search of mermaids. And it's another story. We've had some very interesting adventures.
Sounds like it. And I believe I remember one time you mentioning about the unicorns that, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I remember you one time mentioning that when they become a single horn, a unicorn goat, after you do the little technique, do they become, for whatever reason, a little more aggressive?
Well, it's not aggressive exactly. I mean, you know, male horned animals all have a certain innate aggressive and dominance thing that they do, especially with each other, you know, because that's what they do. That's part of why they have the horns, so they can bash heads and stuff. The thing is, a unicorn is equipped with a lethal weapon there. They don't just sort of bash their foreheads together, you know, because their forehead is equipped with this lance. And they quickly learn how to use that because they can see the end of it. You know, so they're looking all the time, all the time. They're looking right in front of them at this horn growing right out of their forehead. And they use it. They use it to do things, to dig stuff, to untie knots, to poke locks, and they use it to fight with each other. When two of them get together, we have to, you know, control them very carefully. But we did set up a few things just to see what would happen. And they would, like, rear up on their hind legs and fence like fencers. It was quite remarkable and could be quite dangerous. So we had to be really look out for that. So the amount of personal attention that we had to put into them raising was just tremendous. We slept with them from the moment they were born all the time. We raised them indoors. They had to be house trained. They had to be totally conditioned to be, you know, sweet and gentle and all that stuff, and just all the time, you know, very, very close attention to that, because they could be potentially quite dangerous.
Yes, that was going to be my question. House training? How did you house train a unicorn?
Well, pretty much the same way you house train a dog, you know.
They, oh, okay.
You know, they're smart, and they can be taught to, you know, only poop outside and not in the house, you know. It's pretty much the same as training a dog.
Okay. And now, from the unicorn thing, which was still involved with Church of All Worlds, and we mentioned also the Forever Forest and a few other projects, let's go now into Anwen, and maybe you can describe Anwen a little bit, the property there.
Okay, sure. That's actually pronounced Anwen, one of these
Welsh
words.
Oh, Anwen, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but it's pronounced Anwen. Well, that's land. That was Gwydion's land initially. He called it that, which is the Welsh underworld, and Gwydion had this thing about nomenclature, and he was always kind of cynical and grumpy about stuff. He felt that a song that he used to sing all the time was not one that he wrote, but it was the line had, "If you call some place paradise, kiss it goodbye, because if you make it sound too attractive, then everybody wants to move there, and it's no longer paradise." And he thought that they're calling the ranch, the name of the ranch was Greenfield Ranch that we lived on. He thought that was just sounded too inviting. He agitated we should rename it Rattlesnake Acres. And the parcel up above him at the top of the hill, the woman who got it was this very idealistic, sweet, hippie girl, and she named the place Heaven. And so he, you know, being a curmudgeonly guy, he said, "Well, I'll name my place Hell then." But he was Welsh, so he had to name it Anwen. That's how he got the name.
I'll find one or make it up. I thought I saw it pronounced Anwen somewhere in some old English reference, but that's okay.
He always insisted it was pronounced Anwen and that it was Welsh, and so I'll have to, we just go by what he said. We didn't know any better, you know. He was a Welsh guy.
That's true.
But he died, you see. He put it in the name of the church, and it was 55 acres right next to where we were. And then he was killed in a car wreck in 1982, and we ended up inheriting the land, and we still have it. It's still our church's little sacred sanctuary and up in the mountains, and we still do a lot of our stuff up there. We maintain a constant presence of people living there and gardening and maintaining the place and holding festivals and in retreats and initiations and vision quests and all kinds of things. It's a lovely place, but it's very remote and inaccessible. That's how it is.
And that'll lead me to my next inquiry, then we'll move on probably to something else.
All right.
And that is, what do you see for the future of the Church of All Worlds? What I mean by that is, are you kind of keeping it where you like it now? Are you planning on, are you looking to expand and generate more clergy and such? Just a curiosity.
Well, we definitely are looking to expand and generate more clergy. We're in the third Phoenix resurrection phase. We've had several times when the Church had expanded to a significant force and become well known, and then for some reason had kind of, you know, collapsed and into a pile of ash, as it were, and then started all over again. And we had the last cycle of that happened at the turn of the millennium, when I won't go into the details, but it all got burned down to the ground, as it were, by folks. And we've been rebuilding it ever since. But the nice thing about that is that then you get to kind of start all over, learning from the mistakes and coming up with new ones anyway, hopefully, but not the same ones. And it's a very creative time. So we're in this phase now of a rebuilding a new vision. And in the process of that, one of the things that we did at the very beginning was to release what we call the Church of All Worlds tradition, because over all these many, many years that we've been doing this, lots of the stuff that originated in the Church of All Worlds had been spread out into the wider community. A lot of the liturgy and the rituals, the hand fasting ceremonies that everybody uses pretty much originated in the Church of All Worlds, because we were the first legal pagan church to legally ordain legal clergy. And so we were the first one to develop a lot of the liturgical materials for that. And, of course, the water sharing, everybody does that now. You know, everybody, you know, shares the chalice and says, may you never thirst, you know, may you never hunger, all this stuff. And many, many other things. Thou art God is the whole Gaia vision. That was part of us, came from here, the whole idea of the whole planet being a vast living organism. Everybody, you know, takes that for granted now, of course. But didn't start off that way. At the time that I first proposed that, it was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we tried to encapsulate what all the things were that we thought were important and the precepts and principles and, beliefs. I'm always cautious in using a term like belief, because people think that means something you're required to accept whether you think it makes any sense or not. And, you know what I mean.
And my opening Aristotle quote was that mentioning that an educated person is willing to, you know, sort of, I don't have the quote in front of me now, I've lost the paper, but it speaks to the fact that you can accept the thought without necessarily, you know, becoming too attached to it. You'll explore it and believe it. So
exactly.
That's
exactly
part of intelligence.
So, yeah. So we put some energy at that a few years back into kind of conceptualizing all this stuff, these precepts and things, and then just put them out and they said, look, you know, if you like this stuff, then go for it. You know, make whatever use of it you want to. You can credit the Church of All Worlds tradition or say you're part of the Church of All Worlds tradition, and that doesn't mean that you actually have to join up or pay dues or be officially a member, but you can still identify with the tradition. And we took that from the point of view of all the Christians who call themselves Christians but wouldn't have anything to do with any of the organized churches, which they do, you know, think are terrible. And we thought, well, you know, considering that at that time things were not looking too good for the church as an organization, it was in the process of completely self-immolation, and we just let it do that. We let the people who were doing it go on ahead and burn the house down. And we put this out. So, hey, everybody. It was sort of a diaspora thing. And that's worked out very, very well. And we're quite happy with that. So now that we're rebuilding, a lot of our vision now is around online kind of stuff and communications and being a resource center and developing our website. And a lot of this is modeled over what I did in the meantime, which was create the Gray School of Wizardry, which is probably one of my finest achievements. I'm very, very proud of the Gray School. And the process of doing that out of whole cloth gave a good idea of putting a lot of ideas in place that I thought, oh, this could work for the church, too, once I get all these things set up here. So that's another whole part of the story.
That's something we were going to get to. And by the way, when I picked my paper up off the ground, the quote by Aristotle that I was trying to quote is, it is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it. And
I like that.
Again, you're just going back to intelligence, open-mindedness, and not being fixated. And I first started my path beyond Southern Baptist. It was actually, I was a Taoist, and I was taking Kung Fu. And it was a lot about attachment and just letting go of things and don't let things get too heavy and be light and be in the center of your being. But what I want to get to now, because I have to take a brief break, but Janice is still here. I just have to go take care of something real quick. Janice will be asking a few questions about the Great School and bring us into the modern era a little bit. I'll be right back.
Only nine questions about the Great School. Nine's a good number. Yes. Well, tell me about your Great School of Wizardry. Sorry, didn't come out.
Okay, that's the question. Tell you about it.
That's number one. I have eight more. So, was it supposed to be the next Hogwarts or the real Hogwarts?
Not exactly. And people always say that, of course, and it's understandable that they would, but that really have had no idea of trying to be or anything like Hogwarts exactly. But for years and years, I've been back in the very early days in the 60s when we started the Church of All Worlds, we were also seriously considering that we should start a school. In fact, Lance and I both got teacher's training and teacher certificates and put a lot of thought into a school. There were some experimental schools coming out at that time, Montessori and Summerhill and Walden and stuff like that, and we did a lot of modeling for a school, but it seemed like there was a much more urgent need for a new religion because there were all these schools, and they were looking pretty good, and we didn't feel that that our efforts were needed there so much. But nobody was really doing a new religion of the nature that we thought there should be. In fact, people were even putting out things out into the public, like why we need a new religion was a big issue. And so that was what we did. But the school thing had always been in the back of our minds, and we developed our own training system in the church and so on. But, in order to reach a critical mass to support something like that, you have to have a certain degree of public acceptance and interest, and you have to strike when the iron is hot, and when you can't steamroll until it's steam engine time, which is a Heinlein phrase. So what happened was that And for years, the Church of All Worlds, we were the first pagan organization to include the kids and the whole family. And when we started it in the 60s and clear into the 70s and stuff, all the other groups were like kind of, Masons, like secret societies for adults only that would meet, privately after hours and have the kids all off with a babysitter or something.
Right.
And we were like for the whole family, always. And that was another thing that set us apart in the early days. But now, of course, everybody's doing that. Now paganism is a tribal family thing, and we think that's great, but we started it, so And for years I've been concerned that virtually every pagan organization and group, especially the witches, were not even allowing children to participate, or especially to get training. You had to be 18 to even, apply to get training.
And why was that? Why was that?
When?
Why?
Why was that? People were concerned that that parents or somebody would be, would call the cops on them or something like that. People were just afraid. There was a lot of fear.
Okay.
And validly so. There was lots of places, even today in the country, where, if you're known to be pagan, the neighbors can come down you know, and burn your house down kind of stuff. It's a lot of people still live in fear. But we never did. Somehow we figured, well, nobody had it out for pagans in those days. People had it out for witches. But pagans were seen as kind of, you know, kind of neat. Like, people talked about the pagan splendor of ancient Greece and Rome, and mythology was really popular, and kids in school were taught, you know, pagan myths and legends, and it wasn't really considered to be evil or even controversial to be pagan. It was just kind of neat. And that all changed much later in the late 80s and stuff. But why the school? Well, after my talking about this a lot and doing a lot of stuff and developing a lot of kids things, we were the first church, I think, to develop a full kids education training program and kids membership stuff and all kinds of stuff. Then came the Harry Potter phenomenon, and suddenly everybody was into it. And what happened was that Morning Glory and I got invited by a Jewish shul in South San Francisco area to come and give a talk on the eve of the release of the first Harry Potter movie. And they had wanted to find a real witch and wizard to come and talk to them about it, because a lot of people were concerned about, is this going to somehow be evil or satanic, you know, and create a problem for the kids. So they got this bright idea, well, why don't we invite a real witch and wizard couple to come down and talk to us? And there just weren't a whole lot of people who qualified with that identification, and they found us. So they invited us down, and Maureen Gloria and I just showed up, and we showed up in our full regalia, and we, you know, we brought a bunch of props, and we talked to the kids and the parents and the teachers. Everybody was there. It was the kids, parents, teachers, everything, after hours. And we talked about the elements, you know, and the principles and magic and all of this stuff. It was very nice. And then afterwards, they had tickets for everybody for the movie. They had kind of reserved the entire balcony for the opening show of the first show. And so there we were. Well, we were still in our full regalia, but we figured, okay, you know, we'll go for that. So there we are. We show up, and the whole place is full of kids in pointy hats and robes and stuff. And it was really neat. And we're sitting up in the balcony watching this show, and I'm looking down over all these kids down below, and we're thinking, wow, you know, this same thing is being repeated in millions of theaters all around the country and ultimately all around the world. This is going to be huge. And these kids are going to now, some of them are going to say, I want to go there, because the mythos of the J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter stories was really quite novel. Prior to that, all these stories of magic had been that it's someplace far away. You can't get there from here. You know, another galaxy far, far away through the enchanted wardrobe somewhere over the rainbow, you know. But you can't get there from here. But the Harry Potter mythos said that, well, the witches and wizards are in the real world. They're just, you just don't maybe notice them, as you might pass them on the street and somewhere down some alley or some country road, there's they have their gathering places, you know, and their little places. Well, that's true, you see. It's actually true. And we're not that hard to find, because every city has occult stores. And kids can come looking for us. But what are they going to do when they come looking for us? They're going to be told, no, you can't come in. Yes, we're here, but no, you can't have any. And we said, that's not right. That's not right. Somebody has got to be there for all these kids who are going to come looking for the real thing. You know, sure, the stories are nice and a lot of fun, and yeah, sure, they're just stories. It's not real magic and real wizardry, although the principles and ideas and values are real and good. But there is real stuff, and some of them are going to come looking for it. So somebody had to make it ready for them. Then that was when I realized that the time was finally right. And at that point, since the Church of All Worlds had kind of folded for its time, I felt like this assignment had been handed to me. And I've lived my whole life with, like, Mission Impossible. You know, I get these phone calls from the goddess, you know. Your next assignment, should you choose to accept it?
Phone call you have to take.
Yeah, because, you know, if you say no, they cancel your show, you know. And I don't want my show to be canceled. I'm still having a good time. So that's kind of what happened. So I first thing that I ended up doing was writing this book. And that kind of came to me. It was like a series of synchronicities. I got asked to write a book on this stuff, you know. I had a publisher said, oh, will you write this book for us? And I said, sure, it was exactly what I wanted to do. So I wrote the Grimoire for the Apprentice Wizard and set it up as like a textbook for a school that at that time only existed in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the process, the next thing to do is actually make the school really exist, and that was a whole process. And it worked. It worked really well. And now it's become phenomenally successful. I'm so happy with it. We've got over 450 classes right now and a couple dozen teachers. And,
yes, I wanted to ask about that.
Yeah.
I know you were talking about children, but I know there's a mm-hmm. couple adults out there, or might be out there, including myself, that is interested in the adult program of the Gray School.
Yes. Well, that was funny. When we started off, when we opened it up, we thought it was going to just be for kids. We were just not thinking clearly. And when we opened our official virtual doors at Lunasad of 2004, we were amazed that three-quarters of the students rushing to sign up were adults, some of them up into their 70s. And we quickly had to adapt our programs and our setup and our everything for adults as well as kids. And today I think we're about four-fifths adults, actually.
Really?
But,
interesting.
Yeah.
So the
yeah,
adult can enroll in a journeyman class or a course?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's phenomenal. We've already had a bunch of graduates, and we're starting to plan now for our next level, which will be the journeyman level, which would be the equivalent of a college, four-year college level stuff. And, it's going great. We've got 16 departments, pretty much covering every aspect of magical, departmentalization you can come up with. And it's seven levels. It's... I'm really, really proud of it. So please, I urge everybody to check it out. This is, I think, one of the greatest gifts to be offered to the community is the accessibility of this incredible material. And it's not religious. That's the neat thing about it. I mean, we're not anti-religious, but we are not a seminary. We're not promoting any particular religion or church or anything like that. We have students of all different religions. Our second graduate was a Sufi Muslim student, you know, and he was... You know, so we have really interesting discussions among the students when it comes to this, but we're not pushing any particular religion, even though probably the vast majority of everybody participating is pagan. We're not trying to say that's the one true right and only way. And
okay.
that alone is the most important thing. When I said early on that we discussed a lot about what we could do to keep our new religion from going sour the way so many others have, that was the thing. We analyzed what they had done wrong. And what we came up with at the top of the list was this idea of the one true right and only way. And we decided that if we were going to create a new religion, it had to be premised on the foundational concept of diversity, that there is no one true right and only way, that a poly-diversity path is what we needed to do. So polytheism, poly-everything, really had to be core to this, and we set out to embed that so thoroughly throughout the growing pagan movement that nobody these days could possibly get up there and proclaim themselves to be the one true right and only way without being laughed off the stage. And I think that was very important with all this. So there you are.
Especially in the pagan world, it's so vast, and then even if you go into one subculture of it, it's going to break up into a, you know, 12 other ones and so on.
Yep.
And one thing I wanted to comment on about the children, and there's a debate community as to what age to start teaching children. We could say paganism or magic or metaphysics. Sometimes there's a debate between, okay, what is that actually? Are you just talking about techniques, spells, whatever, divination, or are you talking about the slightly more religious aspects, or are you just talking about the lore, right? You can always start teaching a kid lore, because some people debate, I don't want to promote a quote, back to that word people are scared of, religion, to my child. Mm-hmm. But in one aspect of paganism especially, is because in the era that you're very familiar with, where the neo-pagans were coming about, and including the Wiccans and other people, there was a lot of what you might call adult behavior involved, such as, or what people would see that in a modern culture, which would be things like, you know, ritual nudity. There may have been a degree of intoxication involved. I'm not being critical. I'm just saying that this is a reality. I've been part of groups like that back when I was younger and a little wilder, where some of them were partying pretty hard during the ritual and people were getting naked, and it would turn into a sex party, whether it was supposed to or not. So that sometimes would cause this division of adult and whether or not, which again goes back to the importance. Not that there's anything wrong with that if that's what the people are doing. This isn't, again, I've said I've been there. This isn't a judgment call. But when you're talking about having kids involved, and especially other people's kids, of course that's a horrible idea. And that's what's nice about doing something like you're talking about, and other traditions are, Church of All Worlds, where it's a structure, here's the rules, here's what you know is going to happen, so it's okay and it's safe for your kids to be involved.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, safety. You know, it has to be safe, and I'm very proud that we have a phenomenally good record in the pagan movement with millions of people worldwide, that we do not have scandals of, you know, buggering choir boys and things like this, you know? And I think that's really magnificent, that we have a really good record with our kids. We love our kids, we treat them well, we look after them and protect them and care for them properly. And certainly there are activities and behaviors that are adults only, naturally. That's always the case. But that doesn't mean that you can't also have other stuff for the whole family, you know? I mean, you know, it should all be there. And in these days, you go to some of the big festivals, and, you know, there's an awful lot of stuff right out there, but it all seems to flow okay, and there's kids' activities, and there's adults-only things at midnight, and everything is fine, you know? And everybody's skinny-dipping in the pool, you know?
To me, that's just balance, just like everything else, right? You have your adult activities, and you have the ones that's okay for the kids.
All right, exactly. I mean, you know, that seems to work, and I don't really see any problem. So that was kind of the way we always felt it should be, and I'm very happy to see that this kind of stuff has worked out very well. I'm very pleased with the community, how it's developed. In each new generation, I'm prouder and prouder of, you know. I want to make sure to emphasize that I'm in no hurry to conclude this particular incarnation, which I'm enjoying thoroughly. I also look forward to the next one.
I don't think anyone's in a hurry.
Right. But I definitely look forward to coming back the next time around and growing up in this community that I spent my life helping to foster and create, you know, because it's really nifty. And, you know, and I love the kids. I mean, when I go to festivals and stuff, you know, I'm people refer to me as the kid magnet, you know. I mean, I'm just always hanging out with the kids and having a great time. I think it's wonderful. I love these kids. You know, I've watched these people growing up for 50 years. I've had several generations of kids that I've seen born into the community, and I've known them since they were infants, and I've been there for them as they've grown up, and I've been their mentor and teacher until they become adults and have kids of their own and bring their kids around to meet kids that Morning Glory and I were aunt and uncle for on the ranch, now send their kids to spend, you know, summers with us, to be fostered out, you know, to just hang out and learn from us. And I'm really proud of that, you know. Right now I'm working with one of our very first students, Kiri Johnson, and we're creating a children's book called Song of Gaia, which I really would like to tell everybody about, to please go and look up the website, songofgaia.com, because that's G-A-E-A, Song of Gaia. And we've got an illustrator that we need to raise money to be able to pay to complete the illustration, so we're doing a fundraising campaign for that, but it's a fabulous children's book. It's a whole Gaian creation mythos in poetry, and it's just lovely. And she came to us because, you know, her kids were now going to school, and she wanted to create some appropriate creation story for them to counter the, you know, Bible story kind of stuff that they were getting. So it's an ongoing process.
I wanted to briefly take a pause because we had a guest on the phone I wanted to bring on. He's my former co-host of the show, and I'll give him a symbol here. Mr. Kevin Baird. Are you there, Kevin?
Oh, I'm here.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello, how are you all?
Fine.
Yeah. Good.
You guys are asking fantastic questions for Mr. Oberon. And, Oberon, I'm just going to say welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. I'm having a great time here.
I think you may know me from the templeofgaia.com website. We've been in correspondence over the years, just a little bit on and off, you know, like LinkedIn and other places as well, Facebook, that kind of thing.
Yep, yep.
My question to you, sir, just real quick, might be like two really in there real quick, is that you had talked about the water, right? Back.
Yes.
Could you touch on that again?
Well, I mentioned that in the book, Stranger in a Strange Land, the ritual idea of the sharing of the water symbolizes the sharing of life, because water is the universal medium of life. And so the ceremony of a water sharing and declaring yourself to be water brothers is a very important part of the whole storyline. But we really have taken that much, much further and deeper, I think.
Okay.
Because we've come to understand that water is universal throughout the cosmos. We've found water on Mercury, water on the moon, water on beneath the sands of Mars, everywhere, you know. And we're coming now to understand that the water of Earth has come to us from space and is still coming, that comets of icebergs are constantly hitting the atmosphere and turning into water vapor. And so
let me ask you this just real quick. Because I've been studying the water phenomena as well, and someone, I think it was a professor in my past, who mentioned that, like, he passed out bottles of water in the classroom, and he's like, here you go, here's the, you know, like an Avion or Deer Park or whatever, and he said, I want you to know that this water that you're drinking right here could be a part of the bath water of Socrates or Plato or even Jesus back in the day whenever he was doing the baptisms, that kind of stuff. And that got me to thinking that as water passes through us, you know, like we're, what, 98% water, that as water
More like 80, but close enough.
Okay, 80 then. So as water passes through us, is there a chance that we imprint the wisdom that we realize as a part of retaining that water during the process of, like, you know, discovery or wisdom gaining or whatever? Because my question that this is segueing into is that we're having the ice caps melting right now, and that a lot of ancient water that had been frozen and locked away is now being released upon the planet.
Yes.
And a lot of the intellectuals now are getting a chance to be exposed to that. And I was thinking that there might be a correlation between the ancient wisdom that's locked into, let's just say, you know, like as a computer memory that somehow is related to water, is passing through the intellectuals of our time, the engineers, the philosophers, the doctors, and maybe transitioning us into an age to where solutions might be more prevalent than what they were in the past. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I am just totally delighted that you said that, because this is marvelous that you've clearly come up with this independently, and I totally, completely concur with you on all this. The solution, as it were. I often tell people that the water in this chalice that you are drinking now, you know, was once upon a time drunk and pissed out by dinosaurs, you know, and
yes.
And that whole continuity, all water is one water. There is no separation. You know, it all comes from the common pool of the universal water of the universe, but it passes through the membranes and in and out of everything, and it's all the same stuff. And therefore, we are sharing water with all life in the universe, with all the water everywhere. It's all the same. And I say this is a perfect metaphor for spirit, because spirit is also universal. And like water, which only appears to be discrete when it's held contained in a container, in a vessel, and I hold up a glass of water, you know, I say, look at this. But the water isn't the glass. It takes the shape of the glass because that's what's holding it, just as the spirit within us takes our shape. But it is still the universal spirit that we are a part of as the universal water, and so on and so on. I go with this, and I go into this with the idea of the well of souls, and that we are, you know, we our individual consciousness are like dipped out of the
of the pool, like a cup of water being dipped out of a pool. And then upon the completion of that cycle, it goes back to the pool to be dipped out again, and so on and so on. This is great stuff. You can go a long way with this. And I love the idea that you've brought up there about that the release of this frozen water releases all of the intentions and the things that were embedded in it, because water picks up all that stuff. It crystallizes. It has all this crystalline structure to it, you know. So
it has magnetic properties.
Exactly. And I think that's brilliant. I hadn't thought of that particular aspect of it, and I'm just delighted that you brought that up. This is great. Go with this, you know.
So, thank you. And as the water is exposed to our engineers that are out there and our innovators and our hopeful intellects of the future,
mm-hmm.
what advice, you know, like they might be listening to this episode of what we're talking today, maybe in like 50 years or something, they go back to some kind of ancient archive to where they push some kind of button that, you know, like you go back to Forbidden Planet to where they're playing some of the ancient tapes or whatever. What, if you were speaking to those people in the future, like of the Forbidden Planet with the Krill, right? It was the Krill and
the Krill, yes.
Robbie the Robot and all that. What could you say to those people, you know, because I see what we went through with the 60s as the Age of Camelot, basically. A lot of people referred to that.
Mm.
And then what followed the Age of Camelot, according to, you know, Charlemagne and all that, was a magical downtime to where the ages were dark and the times were dark or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
we're sort of going through that right now with the economy being all kinds of crazy. What advice can you, like, put out there for people to hold as, like, a keepsake, as inspiration that there is, like, a better tomorrow and that we're just in seasons and cycles of woe and happiness? What can you say to those people out there?
Well, that's a lot of stuff.
I know.
I would certainly remind everybody that we have turned the wheel one little notch further. You know, it's just like every year, you know, we go through the New Year's and the clock ticks over, you know. But, you know, it's really, you know, from winter solstice, from the darkest time, we go to the turning to the light, and every day after that it gets a little lighter and the days get a little longer and so on until eventually you come into full summer. We have turned that point in the ages. We have turned from the tipping of the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius, and we are now finally moving into there, and we are just a few seconds into the new aeon. But the last time we entered the age of Aquarius 26,000 years ago was the time that we call the creative explosion, the time when really the dawn of all things that we consider civilization and culture, you know, began at that time, including the incredible proliferation of those little Paleolithic goddess figurines, those little, you know, mother of all mother images that we see everywhere,
yeah.
But also the cave art and the tools and music and shamanism and all kinds of stuff, everything really that we consider the basis of human culture began in the creative explosion. There's whole books about this, and it all happened last time we entered the Age of Aquarius. So, you know, we have come through the darkest of the time, and this is like, you know, the next morning after winter solstice, you know, that we are in. And I think it's very exciting, and I think that I would like to remind everybody that this means that while the dark times that we've been going through has kind of shut down the magic and closed off all these things and deadened our senses and our feelings, and we've huddled in the darkness and the shadows just trying to get through, you know, we are now coming to a new awakening. This is truly the dawn of a new renaissance, and we're going to see the next of the 60-year renaissances in just a few more years. The kids who were born into this millennium are going to be coming of age in the next renaissance, which will be just like the 60s, and those of us who've been around for a while will be here to teach them. And
that's why Daniel and I built the Main Street Universe Network, is that we push people to look beyond the corporate cube. You're not in the corporate cube.
Mm.
You're not in the cage. You're not in the kennel. You're not in, you know, the crate. of the corporation.
Right.
Where you're out there, you're with your intellect, your skills that you built while you spent time in that cage and that kennel and that crate, and now you've been set free, and now it's up to you to really run with that and transform your world and for the people around you who look to you for guidance as well. That's what we're doing. And
absolutely.
I just want to thank you. Yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you for coming on the show.
That is exactly right. You're very welcome. My pleasure.
And
that's all I have. Daniel, you want to?
Very, very good comments, Kevin. As you can see, that's why Kevin used to be my co-host, and I still listen to his show on Mondays. And sometimes I join him. Occasionally we do readings together, which we might do right now, Oberon. Kevin is the creator of the Horizon Oracle deck. And
wonderful.
I was curious if you would like a reading right now. I'll draw a couple cards for you.
Oh, please.
Okay, and here's how I do it. I'll start it off with my style, and then if Kevin intervenes in any way, that will be fine.
Sure, sure.
All right.
What I like to do is to shuffle, and then have you tell me when to stop. That involves your energy into it a little bit since it's over the phone. So I'm shuffling starting now. And just tell me when to stop.
Right now.
Okay.
How's that?
Now I'm going to divide it. That was perfect.
Okay.
I know that doesn't always make for great radio when you ask the person or the querent to tell. Some of them take a while before they tell you to stop. Yours was just right. Okay. Pick from pile 1, 2, or 3.
Three.
Okay. The definitive.
2 or 1.
All right. That works.
2 or 1?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, all right. 2 or 1. Oh, that's what you're saying. I see. 1.
Okay. And we know, I was trying to avoid saying what the final answer is, but I did. So there it is. Okay. All right. The first card is associated with the time 6:40, and it's the I'm okay card, and it's in the reversed position. The second card is the advertising card, which is associated with the time. This is an oracle deck, as you know, not the traditional tarot. Associated with time 11:55. The third card is the storms card, associated with the time 3:19. And this, if I add all these up together, the I'm okay card is telling me that those around you, there's someone with a degree of worry around you, and it's sort of they need this message of things are going to work out, things are going to be okay. Like someone that might be thinking of some troubles from the past or something of that nature that could come to you. The advertising card is kind of just how it sounds, how you're presenting yourself, getting yourself out into the world, feeling good and confident still about what you're doing and not losing it. And also not overdoing it, but not losing your focus in that and staying strong and staying. Because sometimes, because you've been doing this for so long, I view this as the card saying, don't get burnt out on who you are, because what you have to offer is something still pretty amazing. So just keep going and have faith in it, even though some drama may or others might bring some of that drama in the storm card. However,
okay.
With the pick from 1, 2, or 3, again, we'll do like a little solution wrap up here.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll come to 2 then.
Okay. Okay. And this one again is an interesting one, and it's the faith card reversed. And again, to me, this is playing a little bit into the confidence of the advertising card. And that is, to me, saying others around you. Because in Kevin's deck, when it's reversed, it doesn't necessarily mean the opposite meaning, but that, I mean, this deck I'm reading from, it means the qualities in other people involved. So this is saying that there are a lot of people that have faith in you. So don't let any of these dramas get to you, and don't let Don't be afraid to continue to be strong in, you know, the advertising card in promoting yourself. And things will continue to go, as you said, you know, fun in this incarnation for you, hopefully. But the only one of a little bit of concern was the first one, and that was the I'm okay card in reverse. How would you describe that one, Kevin?
Okay, well, first off, over on, just to let you know that to see what the images look like, you can go back later and check them out, is that you can go to my website, which is templeofgaia.com, just doing a plug there real quick for the people in the archive who are listening also.
All right.
But
I'll make a note of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's G-A-I-A. But he's Daniel has drawn a very powerful card, in my opinion. This one I took a long time with. It shows someone who's sitting on a tombstone looking at someone who is crying over a grave. And the person who's sitting on the tombstone has wings. And this is a message about somebody in spirit who is connected to somebody around you because the card is facing away. This says that there's somebody that's in spirit that's very connected to what it is that you're doing and that they like what you're doing and they want to either communicate through you that they are okay to someone very close to you who might have just had somebody who passed away or something. I designed this card for those people who want to talk to someone who just passed away. And when this card comes up, it gives the people who are in spirit the power to control the reader to pick up the right card, which is what Daniel did.
And Kevin,
communicate. Yeah.
Okay, yes, I wanted to intervene. What I said about the worry, what I meant by that was, yeah, someone else alleviating a worry. I may have worded it wrong.
Sure,
and I think that's
it's okay.
What I'm thinking about the rest of the message is he may be visited in a dream or something by someone telling him, guiding in the right direction.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
And then the second
well, I'm
card.
On the website.
Well,
yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you go to Horizon Oracle, and if you look, it shows Horizon Oracle hours, and it lists the hours. I have 111 images, so I've broken them down by the hour. So what was the I'm okay card, Daniel?
That's a 640 associated with time 640.
Yeah, so you just go and look at the 640, and then
okay,
it gives you a drop down.
The 6 o'clock hour, 640. Oh, there I go. I see how you do it.
Yeah.
Let me just go down and do it. 640, I'm okay. Very clever. And there's the card. I see. Okay, interesting.
So it shows someone who is sitting on the tombstone there, if you're looking at it, and I'm pulling it up now too, and that they're sort of looking like they're relaxing, that they're on vacation, they're on holiday or something. Meanwhile, the person that is at their feet is a little upset about the loss of this individual who has passed. And, you know, a lot of us out there who don't understand the other side, the what I refer to as the group of divinity, which is the acronym for God, you know, this is someone who is trying to communicate maybe to you or through you to someone who's close to you who has just had someone pass away or it's an anniversary or something, that they are okay and to stop dwelling on, you know, the fact that I'm not here and that you need to get on with your life. That's what the message that's related to this card, and that you can see a little more detail about it just by scrolling down and looking at some of the more content or the content that's there. But
yeah, I see.
That was being talked about.
And
well,
in the
you.
End of it, the faith card, now Kevin may have a slightly different definition from it, but the vibration I was getting from the reading was there's a lot of people that it was faith reversed, Kevin, and I was getting a vibration at the end of the day, a lot of people have faith in what Oberon's doing and that he should continue.
Okay.
That with the advertising card going, I think that's a sign of don't. I was getting this feeling that it happens with people that have done things for a long time, and even if, no matter how brilliant they are, that they have this. Anybody does. I do with music or anything. Sometimes you get bored of hearing your own self, your own voice, and you think to yourself, But there's a lot of people out there that love what you do, including everybody here listening and in the chat room and within the sound of our voice. So basically just a nice positive reading saying keep going, keep plugging away, don't worry about the drama, and you may be visited in a dream by someone to help you out. That's all I'm getting from the 640 card, the one he was going over with you. Cool.
So one more time, Daniel, just so that Oberon can write down the times and then he can check them out later. The first one was the 640 in reverse.
Yeah.
And then the second one?
The second one was the advertising card.
And its number is?
The number is, I've already folded them up and put them away.
Oh, sorry.
Well, it's okay. The last one was associated with the time 317, and that was the faith card.
Okay, faith. All right. Okay, cool. Well, there's one thing that's kept me going through a lot of stuff, and that was a quote from Winston Churchill, who said, "When you're going through hell, keep going."
I like that. And by the way, I did find it. Advertising card is 1155. That was the other one.
Oh, okay. 1155. Okay, I'll check
these. And then the storms card was 319. That was facing away.
Yes.
I believe.
The storms card is other people's drama and stuff. So... If that happens, I don't think he has too much to worry about with that. So.
Well, I will check
these. The storms card facing away talks about issues that other people create, sort of like a storm that can come upon you. It can be a literal thing, like an actual meteorological event, but it can also be a drama that somebody posts in your life that you have to deal with or that someone else is dealing with and that you have to support them with it as well. And that's what I've designed my cards to do, is to help give people a heads up of the stuff they can expect to see so they can spend time thinking about it, so when it happens, they can react to it with forethought.
Great. Okay. Wow, this is fascinating, and I love
but
the way
I've
you
But I've taken
up
a lot of the show time already about this, and overall, I just want to thank you for coming on the show, and I want to hand it off to Daniel. Daniel, go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Kevin, very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, I'll turn his microphone off now. Okay, so there was your reading for the night, basically. To summarize it one more time, very quickly again, keep doing what you're doing. A lot of people have faith in you, even though sometimes people have little doubts about themselves. Don't let the drama get to you. And keep the advertising card, keep going, keep putting yourself out there because it's valuable, it's good work. And someone in a dream might actually help you or come and give you a message soon. So that was with the first, the 640 reverse.
Well, that's great. Thank you. Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I hear a beeping. I think Janice's phone might be running out. In fact, I'll just hand her mine. It's okay. It happens from time to time.
I should probably change phones, too.
Janice wanted to continue a few questions as we wrap up. We're getting down to it a little bit.
Okay.
About the Gray School.
The Gray School, yes. I was fascinated with the colors of the Gray School. Because I'm definitely a person that loves colors. I'm surrounded by purple and black right now because of the Ravens, which is also like a totem. But the Baltimore Ravens won the Super Bowl. And I had noticed when I was researching the grade school here that you had 13 colors of magic. And
yes.
I love the number 13. Trust me. So I wanted to go into how the colors of the grade school is incorporated into the grades and the studies.
All right. Well, of course, gray, all colors combined come out with gray, so it's how you get that. And so it's no particular allegiance. But magic has been associated with many different colors of different sorts, and few people have, I think, systematically organized quite as extensive a list as we have here. But I think that the 13 basic magical departments, plus the additional three for practices and studies that are metal colors, the gold, silver, and what is the other one? Let's see. Oh, gosh, I'll have to think about that. It's hard to keep track of them all somehow, but we do have them. You were talking about the black and the purple, basically, things. And these, in the magical studies, black is associated with the dark arts, which includes sorcery. Which is practical magic, and actually really, all aspects of practical magic, really, what used to be called everything from low magic to dark arts. And also the spooky stuff, the children of the night and things that go bump in the night and all the raven type associations. The purple is associated with cosmic stuff, of course.
And power. The purple is always the power color.
Exactly.
Well, chakra.
Yes.
And we do have a caller who I know really wants to talk to Oberon, so let me go ahead.
Oh, we have a caller. I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay, caller 313. Your microphone is on, but await for your symbol. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Daniel, no drum roll?
Oh, it was a cymbal, not a drum roll. Hold on.
Not a drum roll.
We're in a music studio, folks. There you go. You have been brought in by sound.
All right. Hello.
Well, hello. I would just like to say good evening to Oberon and everyone at the station, and formally invite Mr. Oberon Zell Ravenheart to visit Convocation here in Detroit next year, since it's in 2 weeks and that's too short a notice.
I would be delighted. I've never done anything in Detroit, so that would be great. Please contact me.
Yeah.
Just email me, you know.
Absolutely. I'll make it a point to have Kathy or someone from the committee look you up.
Okay, I'm easy to find. I'm on Facebook. I'm all over
you're
the place.
You're on my
you know?
List, and you're everywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I would be absolutely delighted, and I can note that down. However, if this conflicts with PantheaCon, we may have a problem because PantheaCon always occurs. Oh, well, that I could do. I could do that as long as it's not the same weekend.
Yes, it is directly the week after. Several in the community actually do PantheaCon and then hop on a flight home long enough to grab a suitcase and head out here.
I could do that.
Christopher Penzack, Jason Mankey, a number of the people that always come to the warmer weather events all come out here too. So.
Okay. Well, let's work on this. Okay. Cool.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'm going to drop off the line here and listen to the rest of the show.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us, Marcy. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Marcy.
Okay. Well, that was nice. Well, we're getting down to the end of the time here, aren't we?
There's a few minutes left here.
Yep. So do you have any last requests before we go?
Deep?
Yes. I wanted you to explain the lodges for adults, or the lodges for the children as well as the adults.
Sure. The you know, again, this is part of the traditional schooling system where you have, you know, fraternities or houses or things like this, and we have these set up for elemental associations, so people are automatically sorted through a fun little process, but ultimately it's based on your sun signs, which works out remarkably well, into elemental houses for youths, and for those over 18, these are lodges. And it's a smaller grouping that you can have a closer affinity. And for the lodges, it's adults only, so you can have more adult-level conversations and not have to be concerning yourself with not saying things that kids wouldn't find appropriate. And it gives there's lots of different smaller groupings within the school. The social life of the school is every bit as intense as the academic life. We have summer camp conclaves all over the country and actually all over the world now. We've had our first one in France just last summer. And these are like 2 week or 10 day to 2 week summer camp things, which are really nifty. We have
People can actually meet each other face to face.
Yes. Exactly, meet each other face-to-face, get hands-on lessons and stuff, sit around the campfire, sing songs, tell stories. It's really fabulous experience, just wonderful. People just love the conclaves. We have lots of different kinds of forums, from the Great Hall that everybody participates to the houses and lodges, and, of course, the classes and courses and departments have their own little forums and things. There's for adults, there's a campus tavern called the Wizard's Keep that people can come and hang out with. It's a lot of fun. It's a whole little fun thing there, just kind of like going into a tavern and having that kind of a thing going on. And there's a student magazine comes out quarterly called
Whispering Gray Matters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Although I think they've shortened it to Gray Matters.
Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yeah, well, it's just it's entirely student produced, and it's awesome. It's a really good high quality magazine. It's substantial, like 80 pages or something sometimes, and so that's kind of cool. There's just all kinds of things going on. There's clubs. There's lots of clubs. Lots of the departments have their clubs. There's a healers club. There's guilds. There's There's gardening clubs in the departments of the Green Magic, the Wort Cunning department has gardening clubs. So just all kinds of stuff. It's just rich.
So what club would I be really into, or do you think?
Well, I think you would have to come in and start taking some classes and see what you feel most comfortable with. If you come into the school, what I recommend is to just kind of start off in the introductory classes for each of the departments that you find at all interesting. You can check out the syllabus. You see, you can go to the website, and if you go to the left-hand menu, it says Departments of Study, and you can open up these, and it will give you an introduction to each department. And tells you about what the department covers, and then within that is listed all the classes that are available in that department, and you can check out what looks interesting, and you can check out the little syllabuses, and you can do this before you actually even sign up for class. And if you're in a degree program, the one that ultimately culminates in becoming getting a journeyman letter, then we expect a major to be declared in the second year. And that gives you a little time to sort of get a sense of it. But people have done multiple majors, and there's people who've stayed on and on and on to and accumulated majors and have gotten as many as 9 years or levels worth of studies before they finally completed it with what they call a rainbow major. It's just, because there's just so much stuff there. It's just hugely rich. 450 some odd classes. It's impossible to really get them all. But it's an amazing resource and a wonderful place to go. And I really hope that millions of people eventually will come to the Gray School. But and we've got our incredible faculty of amazing teachers and many of them authors of the
yes,
key
I know
books
a few of the teachers actually.
Yeah, they're great. And we'd love to have you there. Love to have you be a part of it. A lot of the people started off as students that took a bunch of classes and decided that eventually wanted to become teachers. And all the teachers, of course, are also get complete free student admission to pursue the classes too. So most of our graduates have been teachers as well, although not all.
Okay, we're getting down to it now. Oberon, I'd like to start off by thanking you very much for joining us this evening.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, and this has been Oberon Zell-Ravenhart, and you've heard some of the many interesting things he's done with his life. And just as we come out of the show, I want to do a few plugs. First of all, for our guest, Church of All Worlds, what site or thing are you working on right now would you like to promote, Oberon?
Well, if you're talking Church of All Worlds, I just go to caw.org and just take a look at what interests you. It's in the process of an intense developmental phase right now, so things may be still in process, but check it out and get involved in any way you want to. The Gray School, of course, grayschool.com is just, a terrific resource. We're certainly happy to have people actually support our family business, which is making altar figurines and goddess statues and magical jewelry and books and all that, and that's mythicimages.com. And please do that. We do need to have some financial support for our family here. We're going through hard times, medical stuff and things like that, which some people know about. And that's always a challenge. And then, of course, I mentioned the Song of Gaia, this book that I'm working on with my student here, which is really just a wonderful thing, and I really want to recommend that to everybody, too. And those are probably the most important things I'd like to tell people about right now, yeah, really. So there you go. And, of course, if you want to see more about me personally, I have a Ning site as well as a personal one, and both of them are Oberon Zell. It's oberonzell.ning. It's the best one to go to because that opens up everything else, really. So there's probably your best single place to go to, Oberon Zell Ning, .ning thing.
Okay.
So,
and
there you go.
A few plugs of my own very quickly. One is our listener Marcy here has an Etsy store called Spider in the Garden, if she wants to put that up.
Mm-hmm.
We attach it. We attach that to most of our shows. I didn't have time today, but I'm going to the. We have Raven Gormasi coming on later this month. We had Chris Penzeck earlier, so we've been growing and growing. We're a network of five shows now, ourselves, Kevin Baer, Jesse Ann Nicholas George, Mary Thielen, Darren Bouquet, as well as ourselves here on the Main Street Universe flagship show. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We're running out of time. I'm going to put in the song. Thank you once more, Oberon.
Thank you, Oberon.
All right, you're very welcome. All right, bye-bye.
All right, thank you. And here's Woven Green, a local band with song Six Sun.